Reading from the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, Chapter 1, Text 8, Vipāryayo Mithya Jñānam Atad Rūpa Patishtam. Error is false knowledge stemming from the incorrect apprehension of something. Om Jñāna Timurandasya Jñānanjana Salakaya Taksur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Vishnam Snapitam Yena Bhutale Shayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Svapadantikam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyasta Kripa Sindhu Bhai Vacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasade Gaura Bhakta Vinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Rama Hare Hare. So greetings from Newburgh, New York. I'm with the Rubbo family. Some of them, you know them from the festivals that we hold here. Excuse me for being a few minutes late. I flew in from Washington this afternoon, and the flight was delayed. And then when I got into Newark, I had to drive upstate and kind of just about, you know, kind of settled in and now ready for the class. So here in the beginning of the Yoga Sutras, we're working on the definition of yoga, which is the basis of what this book is about. Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. So yoga means the quelling of the vrittis, or the thoughts of the mind. And in many classes I described how that work, that the mind is an instrument, and when it's in its pure state of sattva, that the chitta, or the mind, when it's in the pure state of goodness, it functions to, at a very high level of discrimination and lucidity, and one is able to distinguish the soul, the drishta, the pure awareness, the atma, the person, from the mind and the body. You're actually able to see and understand yourself. And eventually, by the practice of yoga, you're able to abide in your pure nature, which is free from the vikara, or the transformations of the mind and body. And one of those transformations is death. The body will change. And the form which your body and mind is in will completely change, and will become non-existent at a particular time. So if one is not in abiding in his pure nature and misidentifies with the body, then he even comes to the point of experiencing the horror of non-existence, which is actually an illusion, because we are eternal. but will even experience non-existence. And if you're in that type of illusion, then everything you do is filled with duality. When I was young, before 6 years old. I'm not claiming to be any child prodigy, but some kind of slight philosophical impression was in my consciousness. I remember one of them. I remember exactly where I was standing, and I was looking into the future as a young boy. I was younger than six, and I looked in the future, and I started going, and the future was death. And as long as the future is death, then everything you're doing, even your pleasures, will cause you pain, because it'll be mixed with the duality that they're temporary and that you'll lose them. You know, it's kind of like if someone's on death row and they give them a last meal. You know, how much can you enjoy it in that conception? You know, so yoga is meant to be able to is meant to enable you to distinguish the pure self from the mind and the body, and abide in that eternal nature. So it discussed yoga, it discussed chitta, what is the mind, and now we're in the section where it discusses the vrittis, or the fluctuations of that mind. And as we are seeing ourselves through that mind, we will see ourselves according to how the mind fluctuates by so many thoughts, born of passion and ignorance, and of goodness also. So therefore, we won't get a true image of ourselves. And we'll get an image of ourselves that is temporary and constantly changing and subject to dissolution. So he discusses these vrittis, and a nice analogy was like the ocean, like the mind, and from the mind comes these thoughts, just like the waves come from the ocean. And it changes the shape of the ocean. It changes the nature of the ocean, in a way. And these vrittis, these thoughts, they can either be klishta or aklishta. Klishta means tormenting or bad. They can be thoughts move you away from realizing the pure nature of the self, or they're thoughts that can facilitate insight and discrimination and lucidity of the mind and bring you towards those. Those are called aklishta. So after discussing that, the little basic point of the mind, then he begins to discuss the five states of the mind, and that the mind is eternally in one of five states. It's either in the state of pramana, where the mind has a vritti, which actually corresponds with what actually exists. And then you can have, and I'm going to explain them a little bit more detail today, you can have error, a thought that corresponds with something that doesn't exist. And we'll explain that. And then there is vikalpa, or imagination. And then there is sleep. And then there is a smriti, or memory. So there's these five types of states of the mind. The mind is always in one of these states. I should also mention, I call this class a work in progress, and I think anytime you teach something in this type of medium, and you teach it for the first time, it's in a process of kind of getting the right presentation to maximize the relevance and understanding of the subject matter. So I'm open to suggestions, and some of the suggestions I got is, and I think I'm going to follow it, is one, I shouldn't be necessarily confined to go in detail on every subject that's mentioned, but I should take leeway to highlight the things that are most relevant. And in that regard, in today's class, I'm probably, because I went over Praman, I gave one class, I'm going to discuss all the five vrittis in one class, in my own words, basically. So we'll just have one class on the five states of the mind, hopefully leave enough time to sufficient discussion of them, because I know people, I've also got feedback that people really enjoy the discussion. So, and we'll discuss the point of relevance. We should see what is the relevance of this subject practically, and I think I'm going to leave that till the end. Okay, so you discuss pramana, and pramana means the means of actually knowing something as it is, making an impression of some kind of thought or understanding that actually corresponds with reality. So that's one state of the mind. Now, the second state of the mind we can briefly discuss is error. Its error is to have a thought of something which actually doesn't exist. For example, someone can be dizzy or someone can be drunk and they can see two moons. Two moons doesn't exist, but one is seeing he's seeing two moons. He's seeing something that's not there, but he still has a thought about it. Well, when you have pramana or real evidence, you're actually having thoughts of things that are actually existing. So, but nevertheless, the era of perception of seeing something improperly, it still produces a thought in the mind of this person. So you can have a thought of something that exists, and you can have a thought of something that doesn't exist. So obviously this type of vritti or thought in the mind of something which actually doesn't exist, it obviously differs from the thoughts produced by pramana or a valid source of knowledge when you actually see something properly. And there's classical examples of this. In Vedanta, one of the schools, a classical example we all know, is you're mistaking a rope to be a snake. So the snake is not actually there. You're superimposing some wrong knowledge onto an object, but still, in your mind, you have the state of the mind that you're seeing a snake, but you're in error. If the snake is actually there and you have the correct perception and someone confirms that it is, you'll actually be seeing what's there. But actually what's there is a rope, but you're seeing, you're mistaking the rope to be a snake. So you're having a thought of something which doesn't correspond to what's actually there. So these are the first two pramanas. And then there's vikalpa. There's imagination. And really, when I've actually studied, it's very interesting. What they take the third type of state of the mind to be, of the culpa or imagination, it's actually metaphor. It's thoughts of expressions that do not actually correspond to a physical reality. I'll give you an example. If you have a thought of a snake, and you're seeing a rope, you're having a thought of something that actually corresponds to an actual physical reality. You're just an error of it. Well, if the snake is actually there, you're also having a thought that something actually exists, but you actually have the right knowledge of what's there. In other words, you see a rope and you think, oh, there's a snake there. A snake actually exists, but you're an error. Or is someone is not a rope there, but there's actually a snake, and you see it as a snake, then you have pramana, you have the correct understanding of something. But the metaphor is very interesting. A metaphor is a state of mind that doesn't correspond to an actual reality. For example, if someone says time flies, time doesn't actually fly. So it's a state of mind where it's very interesting. Or the sun rises and sets. It doesn't actually rise and set. There's not a tangible reality called time that's flapping about with its wings. So it's kind of an imaginary state of affairs. But the interesting thing, it's actually corresponding to something which has meaning. Where error refers to an object which actually lacks, the culpa also lacks an actual objective physical reality, but error is based, when you say error, it's based on an error of judgment. But paradoxically, the culpa, it's a meaningful expression, although it has no actual physical reality in the world. So it's different than pramana or vipariya, of error. Time flies. There's no actual physical reality in that, but it's a meaningful expression. So that's one state of the mind. It's called vikalpa. And then there's sleep. And sleep is a state of mind. It really refers to deep sleep. It refers to deep sleep because it's not a dream state, because when you're dreaming, it actually corresponds to the last vritti, which is memory. But this type of deep sleep, it takes place when the mind is in such ignorance that it's just a deep, the mind is practically shut down, is covered by ignorance and deep sleep. So it's not corresponding to any object that actually, existed eternally. It's just a state of the mind, like called nidra, dreamless state. But at the same time, it's a state of the mind, because when you wake up, you can say that I had a deep sleep. So there's some cognizance of that state, but it's not vikalpa, it's not metaphor, imagination, it's not error. You're not super, you're actually experiencing something. And it's not pramana, because it's not actual a physical object that it corresponds to. The last one is is smriti, or memory. And what smriti is, or memory, it's the retention of some object that has been experienced. It's basically what happens is you experience something, and that creates an impression. And then what memory is, it's the retrieval of these latent impressions. It's the reactivation of imprints from sense object that one has experienced and has recognized in the past. So it's another state of mind. You're not actually experiencing it now. You experienced it in the past, but you're reactivating that experience from the subconscious because there are impressions of that experience there. There's all different subtle types these distinctions are made. Let's see where I'm going to go from here today. So I guess I should make one more point that, again, you know, so these five types of states of mind that are mentioned, and one is in one of these states of mind. And it's also that any of these states of mind can be klishta, favorable, or unfavorable. For example, how can error be unfavorable? Well, let's say even in the Bhagavad tradition, a mother, this is just a comment, a mother, out of love, does not see her child as grown up. But that vision facilitates her love of mercy. Just think of, I'll just tell just one story here. Because somehow or other I'm going to tell one story here that I think would be interesting. Is I went to see this saint in Brudge. And that saint in Brudge, actually it was Bhakti Vaibhav Purimarj, he's Prabhupada's godbrother. He had an ashram in Sevakunj, and it overlooked Sevakunj. And I kind of went to see him. I was with Borijan. And somehow or other, he heard that we were, you know, people would tell him things that, you know, we were into Raganuga Bhakti, spontaneous devotional service. So he was a very, very, I don't know how you explain it, kind of an emotional person, very advanced, but emotional. And as soon as he came in, he said, oh, so you're into spontaneous devotional service. You know, which means to try to understand the intimate pastimes of Krishna and Radharani. He says, in the West, you don't even understand the love of a mother for a child. Because he heard that in the West, sometimes people abort their children. Because you don't even understand the love of a mother for their child. And then he pointed out the window, and in the window, because it overlooks this big forest of Sevakunj, there's many monkeys. And there was one monkey, kind of, I think there was a baby monkey, and one other monkey, there was a banana there, grabbed the banana and kicked the little monkey off and took the said. And then because he heard that there was abortion in the West, he said, well, in the West, that's the love of a mother for the child. And then he began to describe this. He said, I knew one man in Calcutta, and this man in Calcutta had... He was 95 years old. No, he said he was 70 years old. He had five sons. He had 20 grandchildren, two daughters. And he had 1,000 people working for him. He said that he would only take food from the hand of his 95-year-old mother. And then this person started to cry. He said, that's the love of a mother for the child. So that 95-year-old mother, this person was so big and such a powerful person. He had so many children, and he had his own grandchildren, this man, the 1,000 people working for him. But his mother saw him just as a child. So that's error. He wasn't a child. He was a big, responsible person. But that misconception facilitated love. And therefore, that would be an example where even error can be a klishta. It can be non-detrimental to the development of higher consciousness. And I guess, on the other hand, if you can explain how can pramana or the correct understanding be unfavorable, I guess in a highly critical mind where, perhaps can see every fault or something, and it affects the... I'm going to really stop here for today. I don't know if it's fair to give a disclaimer, but I just got into the long flight, but those are the five. Let me see. Mooney, you can help me out today. Are you on there?
Yes, Maharaj. Dandavat Pranam.
Yeah, I kind of summed up the difference. I guess today it's probably best if people have questions and clear it up. I just got in basically because my flight was late, and I didn't really have a chance to assimilate the notes to the extent I wanted. But I think anyway, it's good to open it up for discussion. How would you respond that, there's five different types of states of the mind, right? And they're explained in these detailed ways. And actually, it gets to explanations. I didn't go into all, like for culpa, a lot of times the mind is, how do you describe it? Daydreaming, fantasy, make-believe, wishful thinking, a lot of people's mind. But that's not actually the culpa. That a lot of those refer to error. They can refer also to memory, wishful thinking. It's a kind of a technical distinctions that and I guess there's overlap, too, but the mind's always... So how would you, respond if someone says, what's the relevance of this to us? What's the practical relevance?
Before we get to that, Marsh, a couple of really quick practical questions, then we can get to the deeper issue of the relevance. Would you mind?
Yeah.
Or would you rather?
Yeah, sure. No, good. Whatever. I just need to have more discussion today. Yeah.
Can you let me know if I've understood this correctly?
Yeah.
The way I understand the first three vrittis is that they're categorized according to how well they present reality or the way in which they present reality to the experiencer. So pramana is that kind of fluctuation of the mind that accurately captures reality. And
yes.
Error is that fluctuation of mind which obscures reality.
Very good. Thank you.
Imagination is that fluctuation of mind which it neither gives you reality clearly nor does it obscure it because you're consciously entertaining a non-reality. Does that make sense, that kind of way of breaking it up?
Especially the last one we can discuss, consciously experience a non-reality. But it's meaningful. Error is not meaningful.
Well,
it's not actually a snake there.
Right. Yeah, right, exactly. Whereas
when you say the sun sets and the sun rises, it doesn't rise and set. It's a metaphor. You're imaging something. So even though it doesn't actually exist, the thought that you have has some real meaning. It's not like an error in judgment. Like when you say error, if there's an error in judgment, you're seeing something that's not there. You're actually you're having thoughts of something that have meaning. you know, but it's leading you to some kind of understanding. But the image itself that the mind is in, the time flies, the sun sets and rises, you know, that itself, that thought doesn't correspond to any objective reality. Where in error, it corresponds to a objective reality, but that's not what you're actually seeing.
When you say objective, you said physical a few times, but I thought you must have meant objective, right?
Yeah, objective reality, yeah, better.
And it seems to me also, Maharaj, that this category of vikalpa is actually really vast. It's not only, we don't only use it in expressions, but in like fictional literature, for example. So people can spend their lives studying Shakespeare, and they're not being fooled. Like, they don't believe that there was this guy, Hamlet, or at least a guy that corresponds to Shakespeare's play in an exact way, and yet they can engage with it in a way that's extremely fruitful. So it seems like this category of vikalpa is actually extremely important.
In your philosophical courses, have you dealt with this?
No, I mean, in terms of, do you mean like the Yoga Sutra in vikalpa?
No, I you know, in your studies, because you're studying six darshans, have you discussed this or studied it?
What exactly? Vikalpa, do you mean?
Yeah.
Not so much, only the, I mean...
Okay. Let me see what it says here. I mean, I'm just going to quote. He said, it is curious that the commentators do not direct specific, more common aspects of imaginative thought, such as daydreaming, fantasy, make-believe, wishful thinking, which actually occupy major portions of most people waking attention. Such things are also vikalpa, but since they depend on the activation of samskaras, they also overlap with other vrittis, such as the function of memory, the fifth type of vritti discussed, or error, since they have no reality. So there seems to be kind of like an overlapping, you know?
Sure. Like, for example, if you're going to read, let's say I'm reading a book of Shakespeare, there has to be pramana because I have to accurately read the words on the page.
Right.
There has to be memory because I'm remembering the meanings of words as they correspond to the kind of formation of letters.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think you're right that we have to kind of choose which one is most prominent, and that's what we give the label to. I think you're absolutely right. That makes sense.
Yeah. But it's within these five states, according to the Yoga Sutras, that the mind is always in one of these five states. There's no other category which the mind can be in. So any thought that you mention will be in one of these five states. Okay.
Yeah. So
which is it's an interesting analysis, you know, that either, you know, coming from Shabda, you know, coming from some scriptural authority or coming from some analysis, that these people have so deeply kind of understood the mind, right, that they can categorize that the mind is always in one of these five states. And there's no other condition that the mind can be in. And if there's a condition of mind, it's in somewhere. If you say dreaming, okay, it's not sleep. It's not nidra, because nidra means dreamless sleep. It's a dreamless state. A memory having slept. Therefore, the memory of having slept well must relate to a state of mind experienced during deep sleep. It's deep sleep. Okay, good. Let's go on. Yeah, good.
My impression,
what else?
My impression too, Maharaj, is that dreams could be a number of things. It seems that they could be memory, but often I think they're just error. They're presenting something as reality which isn't reality. And yet, if we're conscious during our dreams, it may be a form of vikalpa or imagination because we're willfully experiencing a non-reality and not being fooled by it.
Right, he said that. Dreams can be different things. This is really interesting, too. What dream is, it's... which is very interesting. I actually, I was just in Washington, and it was very, very nice. One of the Sangha members, Henry, and make Henry famous, but he's, his father's a diplomat. He's such a good host. It's like he knows the science of dealing with people so well. And I'm able to host people at his house. And last night there was one person there, such a nice man, that came to India on that tour with us, who 20 years working in the Justice Department as a lawyer. Very nice man. Who, an interesting story, when our bus was going from Govardhan, because it was such a packed schedule, Kalilith and Gopi, you know, I've been in Vrindavan, you know, 5 months before that. They're just coming, they haven't come for a while. So they said to people, you know, just the bus will go back to the hotel, you know, the MVT. We want to go to Radhakund. And Kinchana said, okay, I want to go to Radhakund too. So this person from the Justice Department also went to Radhakund, you know. And, you know, Kinchan explained that when you go in the sacred river, you know, you pay a lake, you pay your obeisances, and then they bathe in Shabakarat. And then Kinchan was looking for these Madanga-shaped japa beads for her, you know, for the chanting. So he's looking for these. And, you know, if some of you have been to Radhakund, you walk around, there's all these little doors, and there's a little hole in the wall. And Akinchana goes in a small room, practically half of it's filled up by a bed, another has a stove, and there's just this simple Bengali man there with his wife, and he takes out like a burlap bag to give them like some place to sit on, a real Vaishnav devotee. And he has these Madanga-shaped beads, and then he said, well, you know, he said, I have the beads, but they're not strung. They'll, you know, if you can come back in 3 days, I'll string them. And then Kinchana said, well, just give me the beads because I'm going tomorrow. And then the man immediately strung the beads. And it was such a moving experience to deal with. I was describing that in one of my classes, too, that spiritual consciousness means, And forgive me if I go a little bit off the topic, but I think I'll get back there. But spiritual consciousness means that your material is you're in the center and you're viewing everything as an object. I'm the controller, I'm the joy, everything's an object. And spiritual consciousness means that you become the object and you allow others to see yourself for their service. So here's this old Bengali man, and someone comes in his house. There's a conception in India called Atithi Bhagavan, that the guest is God. And it's such a healthy spiritual consciousness, because generally, you know, when you have a house, you really look at everything in that house strongly, right? It's an object for me, you know? And the concept of immediately a guest comes, and you reorient the consciousness. You know, the house becomes to him. He becomes Bhagavan. He's God. They were so impressed that this man, he comes into his little abode, and it's all about them. He puts out a burlap bag. So this man also got some beads. It was so nice. I was going to mention something here. I got a little bit off the tangent, but I felt I needed to tell stories. Because what happened is I was giving a lecture, and in this lecture, I gave a lecture called The Yoga of Forgiveness. And in many ways, I explained the concept. But at the end, there were some exercises that I got from Mahatma, who gives seminars like this. And after just explaining, and the point I wanted to make is that this resentment is something that's external to the soul. It has to be given up. And you know, it's your choice whether to do it. It's not dependent on anybody else. And when you get to the end, to show them that this is something you want to give up, and it's going to be related to this the class today, I asked meditate on a mental image of what your resentment looks like, a picture of it. You know, how would you draw it? So people went into this deep meditation about their resentment. And they come up, you know, one person says, it feels like you're to give birth to a child, but it won't come out. Another person said, it's like a box, I feel like it's a boxer, but I'm beating myself. Another person said, it's like a brick wall. You know, and they gave such vivid. So one lady in the front, she gave this incredible image of her resentment. I didn't want to describe it. You know, it was like worms coming through her body or something. It was like, you know, and anyway, the whole experience of the class, and then the image of that, and then the hope that one could actually give that up, which kind of plagues one. This night of the class, then the person had a dream, you know, and of it. And anyway, she wound up coming and learning about Krishna consciousness, visiting me. But in terms of dreams, well, I wrote something. It's a memory. It's usually a memory of a very strong experience, you know, and therefore you can interpret it. Generally, with you know, it's an activation of a memory of an experience, and generally it's a fresh experience. I can't find what I was thinking, but let me read something. It says, if the tamasic element that covers the intellect during sleep is accompanied by a measure of sattva, a person feels refreshed and lucid upon awakening. If accompanied by rajas, passion, one feels that one has slept restlessly and one is confused and distracted. If tamas has almost completely dominated sattva and rajas, one feels sluggish and tired upon awakening. And therefore, it's almost a kind of like very, very healthy that before one goes to bed, one does something that nourishes the consciousness in sattva, like reading spiritual stories. Or Satchinandana told me that you can go to sleep chanting mantras. You can just breathe in, Radha, Radha. And actually, I've done that, and it really affects the sleep. But anyway, Muni, so what's the relevance of these kind of subjects, you think?
I don't know, Marge. I think that there's a number of ways in which we can see it relevant. I mean, sometimes I think just reading the descriptions of yogic analyses of the mind can itself inspire us to be a bit more serious about watching our mind.
Yeah.
So even, I mean, that's one thing. Is just it helps us become a little less lazy sometimes at just allowing our mind to kind of transform in various ways, and we start to watch it more.
Yeah,
but particularly about the first two, I'm absolutely convinced that in every single traditional yoga discipline, whether it's in Vedanta or yoga or even Nyaya and Buddhism and everything else, you have to guide your practice according to pramanas, or else you're going to fail. And so I think understanding that pramana is the transformation of the mind which leads to knowledge, that alone, I mean, could give us direction to think, you know, I want to try to be less lazy mentally and try to believe the truth. And sometimes it takes working hard and not succumbing to kind of self-indulgent wishful thinking and stuff like that. So I think even just understanding the distinction between pramana and error as something which is important for yogis, I find edifying. Does that make sense?
It does, and just to understand that there's a state of mind where you're an illusion, right? And how far that illusion extends. I remember one simple example that you this fine white powder and fine gray powder, black powder, right? When you look at it, you see it as gray. Gray is not actually there. There's black powder and white powder, but you see it as gray. Okay, but if you have the right microscope, right, you can actually see it as it is. So I think there's also a concept of just as that's a type of illusion, you know. It's so vivid. You're seeing gray, but gray doesn't exist. You can really meditate to what extent you're not actually seeing properly. And just see how many people in the same situations are viewing the same thing differently, right? There's arguments are on what is true, right? And it means there's different perceptions. And if you look at your own life, I can look at my own life, and every year, I really amazes me. I come to the conception that now I'm seeing things properly. And every year I go through some experience where I get some more knowledge and some more understanding. And I get a clearer view of the world that I haven't had. And then in that year, then when that happens again, I say I see things properly. But I think I also discussed with you this before, that, you know, the mind is an instrument. And if you're using something, you know, knowledge of it helps. And I'm just trying to see how much the Yoga Sutras helped me. It helped me, one, in communicating certain things, right? Just like, for example, even this person who came to me and asked me a question, what does this dream mean? Just the fact that I, you know, from studying the Yoga Sutras, I know the dream state is a particular vritti and how it's caused. It helped me to help her understand what the meaning is, you know? And it was obvious to me that she had a very profound experience in the class to isolate and see her resentment in a particular way and get hope that it can be given up. So anyway, I think, and I would say too, if you look even at the Bhagavatam, right, this is another factor. If you look at the Bhagavatam, there's so many subject matters. I mean, there's calculation of time from the atom, you know, there's descriptions of creation. And, you know, there's relevance in many ways. Sometimes it's just relevance of inspiring God's glory by understanding his potencies and his creation. A lot of times there's relevance by, you know, understanding a general concept. Like you say, well, wow, look at the mind and it's in different states and how should I use it? And sometimes it's a direct relevance in something that one can directly apply.
Something else, Marsh.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's also helpful to see that we aren't, like, our mind does not exhaust our identity. And I think that, you know, it's very hard to distinguish our real self from the transformations that our mind goes through.
Yeah, right.
Seems like our real self is kind of struggling to come through sometimes, and
yeah.
It's helpful to remember that, because I know when I reflect on my mind, there's times where I feel like, gosh, it's like a sick animal.
Yeah.
I remember my spiritual master, Srila Ravindra Prabhu, once said, "If you're alone with your mind, then you're alone with a karmi," meaning your mind isn't good association. And so I think it's healthy to remember that the mind is an instrument that has its own kind of conditioning. And we don't have to necessarily follow it through everywhere, because it's not like we're being untrue to ourselves if we deny ourselves, if we deny our mind from all of its plans. And you were speaking about dreams. I had a dream when I was in Vrindavan in 1994, while I was studying for the Bhakti Shastri, I fell asleep on my desk. And I had a dream, and I know it sounds weird or ludicrous, but I had a dream where I heard my own voice say, I don't know why it said this, but it said, the self is obviously not the mind, because the self can reflect upon the mind. That's what, I don't know why it said that, but I think that for whatever reason, that's true, that, you know, the mind is an instrument. And I think it just helps us, it helps me at least to remember that I don't have to identify with it, particularly in its unhealthier transformations. I don't know if that's
yeah. Yeah, it makes sense to me too that there's some details here, but just the fact that there are details gives some kind of metaphysical understanding, you know, of the mind. And then, you know, maybe the details also sometimes are relevant. You can identify things. Okay, Mooney, thanks. That really was helpful today. I mean, I'm doing more traveling, and I never can tell, and somehow I usually travel on Wednesdays. I never can tell, you know, where I'm going to be. I did prepare copious notes, but I didn't get a chance to look at them. And it was, you know, just a long, in the morning and waiting at the airport, and then the plane was delayed, and then driving here. And then coming here to the Rebels and having Gujarati prasadam in the evening before the class. Okay. Anybody else with any questions? Thanks, Marty. That was real helpful. Anybody else? Okay. Would anybody like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. This is Gail.
I knew you were lurking someplace in the background.
But not with a question, just saying hello.
No, I appreciate when you just say hello.
Oh, boy. It almost sounds like you prefer it.
No. Don't misunderstand me. That was an error on your part, Gail.
And I was half joking.
What? You had a vritti that was prayarya or error.
I was half joking, so it was,
right.
It was overlapping pramana and error.
Okay, and a little viculpa there, too. Because what's half a joke?
I guess, yeah, viculpa.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's going to, you know, the next section is Nirodha, and I think that'll be more relevant to people because it's what is practice on quelling the mind. And so there's a section on it. And practice means dispassion and application, vairagya and abhyas, practice and detachment. So, I read it all through, but now I'm going to have to prepare it again. Okay. Thank you, Gail.
Okay, Maharaj.
Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
My humble obeisances.
Hi, well, that's Amiya. Okay.
Maharaj, earlier in the class, you mentioned two words, and they sounded like Krishna and Akrishna. But I'm
no, Klishta. Klishta, Akrishta. Klishta means...
how do you spell that?
K-L-I-S-T-H-A. Oh, that's Klishta. Yeah, and then is Akrishta. And Klishta means torment or unfavorable. So there's thoughts that are unfavorable, and Aklishta is thoughts that are not unfavorable.
Right.
And thoughts that are not unfavorable are thoughts of, you know, goodness, morality, things that bring one closer, give one insight into one's true nature.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Someone else is out there that said hello? Who's that? It was some other person that said hello? One more friend out there? Terry, like to say something? Okay. Well, anyway, thank you for coming. Next Wednesday, I'll be sitting in my room in the Sun Falls peacefully all day and have time to really prepare the class. Thank you for all coming. Vanchakalpa Trubhyascha Kupasindhu Devacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha.